This is partly audiobook of 25 Years with Lobsang Randpa by Sheila Rouse from 2005. I wish to thank Karen Mutton, the author of T. Lobsang Randpa, New Age Trailblazer, for the generous encouragement and assistance she gave me in publishing this book. Author's foreword. In the 60s and 70s, Lobsang Randpa was almost a household name, yet few knew or had even met him. He was known as an esoteric and metaphysical writer, but his identity was a matter of conjecture and dispute, as was the subject matter of his books. I lived with Dr. Randpa for 25 years, and worked closely and intimately with him. I believe I am the only person alive who knew him well. Not wanting to attempt what even a skilled biographer would find a daunting task, write his biography, I have written my own story of those years I spent with him, focusing on the early years which were the most eventful. His abilities and outlook were too complex and too far beyond the range of what we regard as normal for anyone to be able to analyze him. The story is based on fact, but some names are changed, events may be out of sequence, and in some cases I have created fictional personalities and ambiences. Nevertheless, in all I have, to the best of my ability, painted as true a portrait of Lobsang Randpa as I was able to understand it. I intend my humble effort as a tribute to him. Because I believe in reading for pleasure quite as much as for edification, I hope the reader will enjoy. Vancouver, 2006. Chapter 1. London, 1955. Even now, 50 years or so later, I remember that day quite clearly. There was a heat wave at the time, oppressive, sticky, exhausting weather. It made us all feel irritable and heavy. I recall awakening that morning with a feeling that something unusual was about to happen, but I had no idea then that the day was to mark a turning point, a startling new direction to my young life. Often we cannot pinpoint precisely when such and such a change was actually initiated, but in my mind's eye, and looking back over the years, this was unquestionably the day. As I turned over, I half opened one eye, feigning sleep. I could hear my husband, John, rummaging around, making agitated, impatient noises, opening and shutting, rustling, pulling out and rearranging. I could see him beside his chest of drawers, a massive piece of furniture, Victorian and unappealing to me, but nevertheless undeniably useful and well constructed, capable of housing all his dress needs. John was a tall, well-built man, immaculate as a rule and reminiscent of those advertisements one saw of the typical English gentleman ready to board a Boeing plane, smoke a particularly good brand of cigar, or down an expensive Scotch whiskey. At this moment, though, I could tell, despite the fact that he had his back towards me, that he was irritated and out of sorts. His reddish hair was standing up at the crown, jutting out around his ears. Even his usually compliant striped pajamas were wrinkled and dry. He was in a poor mood, and it was not only the weather, it was something much worse. With a jolt I was shaken out of the comfort of sleep and into the reality of wakefulness. I knew exactly what it was he was searching for. Worse, I knew he would not find it. Darling, where the hell are my collars? The box has completely disappeared. Don't tell me that idiot woman you employ has been at my drawers, damn it. John's voice confirmed my fears. He was in a really poor mood. How to explain that I had discovered Jarvis, our four-year-old, in the garden chortling with delight as he floated seven stiff white collars in a sea of muddy grey water. The leather box submerged and, to my horror as he proudly brought it out and opened it, containing three fat worms. Worm submarine, he had told me gravely, but with a twinkle in his eye. His father would hardly be amused. Chester the old bulldog, a present from my father years ago, landed with a thump on the bed and nosed up to me, snuffly and somewhat smelly. He was a comfort, an ally in difficult moments, and his solid brown body was a reassurance. What about a soft collar shirt and tie, dare I suggest it? Or even a cravat? No, of course not. No one in the city wore soft collar shirts with bowlers, rolled umbrellas and dark suits. It would have to be yesterday's collar. Thank God tomorrow was Saturday, that would give time for the return of the collars from the laundry for Monday. I eased Chester off the bed and wondered why bulldogs were so stubborn. Never mind, we loved the old fellow and he was wonderful with the children in spite of that silly George, our Scottish GP, in his professional doctor manner, getting so annoyed that I allowed him close to the children when they were babies, and even now would never touch the dog. Did he think dogs were unclean, or something? Still, he was a good doctor, one of the best. I refused to have a national health doctor, quite a new thing then, feeling that if we could pay we should. Besides, the national health doctors were overworked and could not give proper attention. It was a bone of contention between my husband and myself, one of a number of similar bones. Look, John, you'll have to wear yesterday's collar. I'll find the collar box for Monday. I pushed my feet into the deep red silk mules beside the bed, and headed for the bathroom. Stupid man, fussing about a collar, it must be the heat getting at him. Who cares about collars, anyhow, only stuffy city gents. Curse them all, may they rot in hell. I was disgruntled, the more so because Jarvis was such a handful and I adored him. He was constantly up to something new and ingenious. The way he had thought of making a boat out of the collar box, and not just an ordinary boat, but a submarine especially for worms. Heaven only knows how he got the box out of the chest of drawers. They were heavy drawers to open and often kept locked. Finella, our daughter, was different, a handful in a more subtle way, probably because she was a girl and the elder by 18 months. The bathroom was the palest green with darker green fittings, restful, a place where one could allow the trivialities of the world to go down the drain. The trouble was that I had not yet mastered the art, and I remember thinking that it was unlikely that John had either. If he had, would he be worrying about his wretched collars? No, he wouldn't. I drew a tepid bath and shook a few drops of my worth essence into it while sitting on the edge of the bathtub and reflecting. As I write, I can almost smell again the perfume, so delicate yet so exotic, as it rose in the imperceptible steam of a cool bath. I even recall hearing the children that morning, already awake in their rooms above, Jarvis agitating to be up and about and Finella, in her little mother role, telling him he would just have to wait, and in the meantime she would show him her new picture book. They were both fair-haired, blue-eyed children, but whereas Finella was destined to be long and thin, was highly strung yet responsible beyond her years, Jarvis was round, mischievous and relatively uncomplicated. In a few minutes Mrs. Wood would arrive from the flat at the bottom of the garden, and get them up ready for breakfast. She had seemed a homely enough soul when I interviewed her for the job as general help, and it was bothersome that John was so difficult about her. Admittedly, she was a bit bonkers when it came down to it. Look at the goldfish, the dog with one lop ear and the mangy cat, not to mention the daughter who never went to school, which meant the school inspector was constantly on the doorstep. But on the other hand, she was kind and willing with the children, and that was something. Since the war ended, it was difficult to balance the servant problem, and I was thankful to have a helper installed in a separate flat over the garage. Perhaps John was right, there was something a little strange about the woman. With hindsight, I see now that she was a stepping stone in a sense, but in the present, in the moment, we see nothing clearly. It is only when we look back that the pieces fall into place and form a picture which is comprehensible, like a jigsaw puzzle, or one of those delightful magic paintings that children used to do, and perhaps still do for all I know, where the picture forms as the child wets the paper with a brush. I shrugged off my nightgown, leaving it to puddle on the marble floor, and stepped into the warm, scented water. The morning bath was my luxury of the day. No one disturbed me. I would lie there and review what I had to do each day and steel myself in readiness. That was how I got through each day. This particular day, and I remember it so well, as I say, because of the events, or the one event, which turned out to be quite momentous. We were invited by a young man, David, whose surname, oddly enough, completely escapes me, but who worked in John's firm, to go to a recently opened show at Drury Lane, or was it the Coliseum? Porgy and Bess, and then to dine late at Prunia's. I adored Prunia's, but knew I would be preoccupied all the evening wondering if Mrs. Wood was taking care of the children, if Jarvis would have an asthma attack, or some other dire emergency would happen. And then there was my own problem with hay fever and headaches, not to mention this horrible heat wave to contend with. David and some other guests of his were coming for drinks before the theatre, so I should get fresh flowers, although David always brought exquisite bouquets from Moises Stevens. He was such a civilized young man. I heard John on the landing outside the bathroom door calling Chester. Thank goodness, I thought, he must have decided he could, after all, wear yesterday's collar. He always took Chester for a short walk first thing in the morning, usually up to Kensington Gardens, which was almost on our doorstep. The real reason for the early walk was that John was quite paranoid about dear Chester defiling his garden. The little garden was his special thing, and I have to admit that he made an excellent job of it. Gardening in London was not easy, but ours always looked quite enchanting due entirely to John's ceaseless effort. We even had things like roses and sweet peas. Maliciously, I often was tempted to find him an oversized magnifying glass so he could minutely examine his beloved plants for any sign of impurity left by Chester when I was supposed to be keeping him off the garden. Anyway, there I was lying in the deliciously scented bath, mentally ticking off all I had to do that day. Looking back, it all seems ridiculously insignificant, but then it was quite different. In my mind it was vital and there was no room for failure. Get the flowers, run round to Mac Fisheries for smoked salmon, get something for lunch with the children, get my hair set, that would take at least an hour and there was no putting it off, not in this humid weather making my fine hair limp as a rag. Oh yes, I had to ring up the dressmaker about next week's cocktail party at the Trenches. I would have to have a fitting tomorrow or the silk suit would not be ready in time. All that to cram in with my usual day with the children and Chester. And I must try to get a 10-minute nap so I would last out the night without hay fever and headaches. As I attempted to arrange it in my mind without panic setting in, I heard Mrs. Wood's heavy step on the stairs, and knew the children would be down and ready for breakfast in 15 minutes or so. I must make an effort, leave the piece of the bath, towel myself dry, go through to dress. I thought of the milkman telling John that I could be seen dressing from the street, and John telling me in his humorless way, sort of critical and disapproving. So what about it? What a pretty lot. They did not have to watch, after all. There might be dozens of different kinds of human bodies to study, not just two. How idiotic. But it was such an issue with John, I took care to keep the curtains drawn, which annoyed me because I felt I had to do it to comply with convention, and convention was another of those bones of contention, bones which were so picked over you would think they would be completely dry by this time and ready to break up, but they were not. They kept on being picked, and picked, and picked relentlessly. By mid-morning the thermometer had crept up and the heavy, thick air hung stagnant and ominous. I thought fleetingly of poor old John in the city with his stiff collar and black suit. No wonder he was so irritable at times. I thought of Jarvis. He could be having a problem with his asthma soon and I would have to see he did not overexert himself. London was perhaps the worst place for him, but what was it George had said? A sort of mother, something, whatever that meant, that caused him to have asthma. A lot of rubbish. No doubt. When he had an attack my whole being was cast into the deepest gloom and panic. What if he died? That was my worst nightmare. The thing I could not face. The thing that was like a sword hanging ready to strike. It colored my life with fear. He was happy at the moment, banging around with something in the nursery, pans from the kitchen cupboard and a wooden spoon. One of our favorite places to go to was the bandstand in Kensington Gardens, and his current project was bandsman. Of necessity it was a noisy project and made Chester quite miserable. It would be a blessing when Jarvis turned his attention to something else. Finella loved the museum in Kensington Palace, and could spend hours there looking at things. It was a small, personal kind of museum and although it bored Jarvis, and Chester, of course, was not allowed in. I encouraged her in her enthusiasm. We were lucky to live so close to Kensington Gardens, and our house was a gem, understated and charming, nothing grand about it, modest early Regency. I loved it, I adore the children, so why were the pools of darkness and fear all the time in my mind? I had no answer, so I just shut it all out and got on with it, as they say. Maybe everyone did that to a greater or lesser degree then. The war was still not yet just a memory. We all, I think, had learned to be thankful for small mercies, and not to fuss over personal agonies at least, not out loud. Mom, telephone, telephone, Finella's shrill voice demanded I come, that I stay on track and do those things I had to do. She kept me in line, a mixed blessing. Going through to the drawing room I picked up the receiver. Hello, yes, this is Mrs. Rouse speaking. Oh, it's you, Madam D. It was my dressmaker. My fitting is tomorrow, isn't it? What, it isn't ready. But it has to be, I absolutely must have it for the Trench's cocktail party next Wednesday, you know that. Lady Trench will be appalled if I turn up in the same old thing yet again, she really will. You know that, Madame D, you know what she's like. This was awful. How could the silk suit not be ready for fitting? It was promised. I pictured my dressmaker at the other end of the line, immaculate in black, tall and sparse, white hair swept into a chignon, no makeup, pearls and gold earrings. Only her feet betrayed a hard early life and a struggle. Such a nice woman, I would love to ask her round for dinner. But it would never do. Her aunt in Bruton Street must be exorbitant, being next door to Hartnell would automatically put it up, and goodness knows how many little women she employed in the back stitching their lives away, ruining their eyesight, getting horribly humped shoulders from bending over all day long, not to mention the mannequin who modeled the Paris samples for you. She probably came cheap because she had such thick ankles. Odd for a mannequin even though the rest of her was thin and long and elegant. But the cost of it all did not bear thinking of, it truly did not. And then her flat in Dover Street, as well. Perhaps there was a man looking after her. I hoped so. As these thoughts raced through my mind I tried to get a hold on my anger and disappointment. I should say it did not matter, I could, after all, wear the same old thing next Wednesday. Who was really going to notice except Jessica Trench, and she would be her usual critical self anyway, she always was. But, oh, so charming. Or perhaps there was something else at the back of the wardrobe. Or could I ask Cordelia to lend me something? No, that was impossible. Although we were devoted friends, we were very different types, she far more glamorous than I, more daring. Our clothes were quite dissimilar. I got a grip on myself and backed down. Oh well, dear Madam D, don't worry, perhaps the heat will be so intense by then that we'll all be prostrate on the ground and frizzled up. A poor try at humor but the best I could do in the circumstances. I felt the headache coming on, and prayed for the hay fever not to overcome me in this heat, it was so miserable, runny eyes, constant sneezing and general lowness of mood. But what were the children doing? There was an ominous silence I did not like, no bandsmen, no singing or dancing. Then Finella appeared at the door again, her pale face full of agitation. Mama, he's being naughty again, Jarvis is being naughty, he's swinging on the Hoover. The vacuum cleaner was kept in a cupboard under the stairs. It had a large ring on the end of the handle so it could be hung up out of the way, and that was how it was. Hung up and movable so a small person could sit on it and swing. Jarvis had devised a method of opening the cupboard door with a stick, and to actually indulge in such an illicit act and forbidden behavior filled his young mind with delight. To sit and swing back and forth on the Hoover in the darkness of the under the stairs cupboard was superb, amusing, forbidden and glorious. The next moment there was a crash, it seemed to shake the house. Then his howls. Together, Finella and I ran to his aid. The hook had given way, and the child was lying with blood coursing down his face from a wound in his forehead and into his open, screaming mouth. The drop could not have been more than 2 or 3 feet, but he must have banged his head on the jagged edge of the nursery fender, put in the cupboard out of the way until it could be mended. My heart was pounding. All that blood. He could bleed to death. Where was that useless Mrs. Wood? Thank God for Fenella. I was in a panic. Fenella, get a towel, quick, I shouted as I picked up Jarvis and carried him to the kitchen sink, all the time trying to quieten him, with my heart hammering, to me, even louder than his howls. Fenella, bless her, appeared in a moment, dragging all the towels she had snatched from the bathroom rails. Soak a towel in cold water, that was the thing, wasn't it, and then press it on the wound hard to try to stop the bleeding. In a minute or two the child quietened down, and I carried him to the telephone. I sat down, cradling him in my lap while I dialed George's number. His consulting rooms were in Harley Street, usually known as the domain of specialists, but there was actually the odd GP there and he happened to be one of them. I knew the telephone would ring straight through to him because as well as being our doctor he was our friend and we used his private number. All the time Fenella was hopping from one foot to the other, concerned, and with a kind of excitement that came over her in stressful moments. She always absorbed my own fear, unfounded though it was. She did not understand it, and it wound round her like a great ever-thickened cord that tied her in knots. Poor Fenella, she should have been born to a calmer, more down-to-earth woman. George answered the telephone at the second ring. He probably had a patient in the big chair across from him who would be staring into space, pretending not to listen to his conversation. But I was beyond caring. Although normally polite, at this moment all I could think of was Jarvis. Look, George, it's Sheila. You must come immediately. Jarvis has fallen and severely cut his head. There's blood everywhere, but everywhere. What's that? Patients waiting. Well, they'll just have to wait. This is urgent. He may die. He just may die if you don't come immediately. My voice trembled. I had to bang down the receiver for fear of bursting into tears. But I knew he would come. He had never let us down. At last it was over. Jarvis was lightly sedated and lain in his bed, his head stitched and cleansed, and he slept the deep, peaceful sleep of the young. After George left, Fenella was put to rest on the drawing room sofa. We had not bothered with lunch, my hair would have to hang limp, there was no time for the hairdresser, and there would be no flowers except those David might bring. The day was not shaping up to my well-devised plan, and it seemed to be getting hotter all the time. Chester would be really suffering, I thought, with his pushed-back nose and the difficulty he had in breathing. Chester? Where was he? No sign of the old fellow. Odd, I thought. He is usually around helping in his own way. Oh well, he'll be somewhere. I placed a handkerchief soaked in eau de cologne on my brow and closed my eyes. My head was throbbing, it had to get better before John came home. But where was Chester? I got up and called him. No response. Nowhere to be seen. I went out to the garden. He may have gone up to see Mrs. Wood who, I was convinced, gave him food he was not allowed to have. I could ask her to go round to Queensway to buy smoked salmon and lemons. It occurred to me as I made my way down the narrow crazy paved garden path to her flat. It was so pretty with thyme and tiny blue star creeper, and here and there moss interspersed between the stones. Little did I know, and I could never have guessed, that when my feet traversed that same path back to the house, something quite extraordinary would have happened, something that was to make me forever apart from all I had known, from friends and family even. I opened the garage door, and as I mounted the stairs to Mrs. Wood's flat I seemed to hear voices. She must have a visitor, I thought, but I needed to find Chester, so I knocked on the door and waited. The voices inside ceased, and the door was opened. Mrs. Wood appeared, but as I looked past her to the figure of a man seated beside the window she faded into insignificance. I knew nothing about vibrations, auras and the like, but such power radiated from this person that I had the distinct feeling of a fire burning brightly. I was awed. My eyes were drawn to and met his, which was somehow long and narrow, piercing without being large, calm and still with a hint of amusement in them. Although he remained seated, my impression was of a short, stocky man with a shaven head and wearing a graying beard. His expression was unreadable. He wore a black suit with a pink shirt and black bow tie. All this I took in a matter of seconds. He was unusual. I had never encountered anyone with such a presence. What happened next was at the time completely inexplicable to me, but since then I have read of similar cases. Only a few weeks ago I read an account by Sybil Bedford of a person's first meeting with a psychic in which she mentions the feeling of receiving an electric shock. As this man looked at me, I experienced something utterly strange. I felt his eyes boring into my very soul, into the being, the self I did not expose, almost did not know or recognize, so used was I to covering up, to pretending, to denying. It was as though I was standing there with my soul stark naked, no pretense, no protection. I had never experienced anything like it before, and never have since. Then I became aware of an awesome tingling all over my body, as though I indeed was receiving an enormous electric shock, and I seemed to be looking at myself from a distance, from above, and I was aware, did not actually hear, but was aware of the knowledge that this was momentous for me, this was a unique chance, take it or leave it. The whole sensation could not have lasted more than a minute perhaps, but a minute can represent a lifetime. Then the man spoke. "Your dog's too fat," he said. With that he chuckled, rose and stepped past me, down the stairs and out into the mews. Chester was there. Mrs. Wood was apologizing profusely. She would have brought him back to the house, she was explaining, but her friend had come to catch spiders in the garage for his minor bird, and had stayed for a cup of tea. In answer to my question, she told me he was the Tibetan doctor who rented a room with his wife in the house she had been caretaking in Queensway before coming to us. Dr. Kuen was his name, a real gentleman. He had done more for her than anyone else in her entire life. And that was the beginning. From that moment my feet were set on a path not always easy to travel, but one there is no denying once it has been revealed. Of course, I had no idea then what was ahead of me, or the meaning of any of it. Now, though, an old woman, I can look back and paint a magic picture as I wet my brush and see the colors and shapes appear. It forms a picture which is important only in that it involves a unique and controversial figure who I was to come to know perhaps better than anyone else knew him. Like the sand in a timer, I feel my life running out, faster each day. What follows is a story only I can tell, my own story admittedly, but also the portrait of a man I loved and came to esteem beyond all others. I think it has to be told before the sand runs through and the timer is turned, because then there will be no one else to tell it. That year, 1955, was no different from any other in that the hot summer mercifully gave way to autumn, the days drew in, became shorter and cooler. We lit fires in the grates, pulled across heavy curtains. Autumn in London was wonderful, altogether the best time of year. The London season was over and done with, people had been away, come back and settled down to normalcy. Everything was in its place again. It was autumn. There was a crispness in the air. The children wore sweaters and gloves. Chester was happier and more lively. Finella was to start school, and it had been agreed that she be enrolled at the Lycée, the French school in London favored not only by the French but also by most of the foreign diplomatic community. She was excited. I was apprehensive, not about her ability at school but about, in a sense, losing her to the inevitable business of growing up. The eve of her first day at school, after putting the children to bed and dining lattish, John and I repaired to the drawing room as usual. "By the way," John said casually, laying aside the Times and as if he were making a comment on the weather, "I've written a letter of introduction to Charles for your Tibetan friend. Perhaps you'd like to give it to him. No doubt you'll see him before I do." I gazed at him in disbelief. "Charles? Surely not Charles?" In my mind, Charles was a detestable man, no manners whatsoever. Of course he was supposed to be clever and had at least one book to his credit, but that did not excuse him for being such a boor. Honestly, John, I can't see him being even civil to Dr. Kuen. Don't you remember how dreadful he was when we met him that time in Sloane Square?